You are listening to WXRWLP Milwaukee, 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti. Once again, I am your host, NTSC, and welcome to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and a lot more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? Well, the ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society might look like, while recognizing that none of us today are truly free. As ever, WXRW River West Radio needs your help. Times are tough for nonprofits, and especially so for nonprofits who seek to engage, educate, and activate the at-risk and the disenfranchised. If you want to help us out, donate today online, join our Patreon campaign, or come into the station at 824 East Center Street and purchase some gear. Or if you represent a local entity of some kind, reach out and become an official underwriter. You can support us, and in so doing, we will make sure everyone knows about you. Okay, so I'm sick this week, or I'm experiencing a hell of an allergy attack, or something of those two options, or maybe both of them together. And it's making me sound and feel weird. Bear with me, and we'll get through this together, hopefully. We're going to talk about a few incongruencies that exist in our modern era, especially in the political discourse that dominates the status quo. But first, I think I need to get some housekeeping out of the way. There's a term that I'm going to be using more often on this show as it progresses. It's a term that people think they know the meaning of and don't. They think it's a term that had its day in the sun. And to be fair, it has enjoyed moments in history where it was the watchword on many lips. But its greatest day has yet to be realized. There are people who believe that we have achieved this word, that we have brought its meaning to fruition, and they are wrong. The term I refer to is emancipation. I'm going to be referring to emancipation a lot, and I'll use the term most often probably to refer to what I'll call emancipatory movements. For example, an emancipatory movement versus a non-emancipatory one. Many people, Americans primarily, have been falsely educated to think that the term emancipation refers to the abolition of chattel slavery in the United States, which officially ended, or was supposed to have ended, the inhuman institution of chattel slavery in what was called at the time the rebellious states. Henceforth, etc., etc. Yes, the abolition of chattel slavery in the Confederate and United States of America was an example of emancipation. However, what it achieved was not emancipatory in the completest sense. To really get our heads around it, we need to look at another issue which was prevalent at the time. In the mid to late 1800s, those issues were indentured servitude and wage slavery. After the Civil War, the bloodiest and the most terrible conflict to ever occur on American soil, the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, the party which had abolished chattel slavery, set its sights on wage slavery. And you may not believe that. It may sound insane by our modern terms. But at the time, wage slavery, to rent oneself to someone, was considered just as bad, if not worse, than chattel slavery. Chattel slaves, for example, as property, enjoyed more legal protections than wage workers did before abolition came around. So, the movement of what was called labor republicanism became very popular in the Gilded Age of the 1860s right through to the 1890s. We've talked a little bit in past episode about the Knights of Labor. Well, they were instrumental within the Republican Party at the time in making the position well known that chattel slavery had finally been abolished in the United States and that wage slavery needed to be next. The Republican tradition holds that anyone who is subservient to another equates to slavery, especially in an economic sense. Obviously, that sentiment is no longer familiar to either of the primary political parties of America, since they have been bought completely by the power of capital. But historically, that was the goal of the Gilded Age Republicans: emancipation from wage slavery. So, in essence, after the Civil War, it became illegal to own a human being as property, but it remained very legal to rent them temporarily. Henceforth, when I say that the world needs real emancipatory movements, I mean that no movement which allows for the wage system to continue or for illegitimate hierarchy to rule the lives of the majority of people can be a movement of any real positive change. And it's that simple. Okay, with that understood, the larger topic of this week's episode is incongruency, or inconsistency, or other synonyms within the modern political discourse. If I were to declare a thesis for this week's show, it would simply be this. You cannot be a feminist and accept capitalism. Neither can you be an LGBTQIA+ ally or advocate for LGBTQIA+ rights and simultaneously accept capitalism as a working system of human organization. Feminism and LGBTQIA+ rights are contrary to the methods, tactics, and reality of a capitalist system. At time of recording, we're on the cusp of Pride nationwide, and already the rainbow capitalism is out in force. There are rainbow vodka labels, rainbow hockey tape, rainbow stickers, and coffee cozies, and it's all very convenient that these money-making ventures are jumping on board now that same-sex marriage is legal. Where were they when Stonewall was happening? But anyway, I digress. We'll start with feminism. It was just International Women's Day not too long ago, I think, right? I don't know. I don't have a calendar in front of me. It would be very easy to attack capitalism as being anti-feminist on the basis of the pay gap, for example, but that's really low-hanging fruit. Instead, let's look at the two largest feminist movements of the modern era, Me Too and Time's Up. Both of these movements sprung from the institutionalized, systemic, structural violence perpetrated on women by men in positions of power. Very visible women, both femme and not, joined their voices together in a chorus to report on events wherein they had been attacked, abused, manipulated, coerced, assaulted, and more by men who held positions of power and influence. And we talked about the growing list of such men in the episode on heroes, so I won't go into it again. Past episodes are available at creamcitymedia.com/anti. But suffice it to say that the list goes on and on and on and on. And the odds are good that any man in any position of power and influence will find himself on that list soon. So don't hold your breath for Tom Hanks, everyone. And although the criticism of these men and their terrible actions is definitely needed and has merit, there was no larger discussion on the parts of these famous actresses, politicians, and entrepreneurs who dealt with these abuses. There was no larger discussion about the very real socioeconomic factors that formed the circumstances under which these attacks occurred in the first place. We may have talked a little about this in previous episodes, but it is very much worth repeating. The structure of capitalism creates power imbalances. That is what it does. It's a machine. You put in people and capital and resources in one end, and outcomes inequality the other end. Social inequality, financial inequality, you name it. It is a byproduct of this system. So you all know by now, if you've listened to a single episode of this thing, that anarchist tradition holds that power corrupts. And it's also an old axiom by this time. It continues to say absolute power corrupts absolutely, but I think it's fair to stop at power corrupts. So scolding and ostracizing the men who commit acts of violence, manipulation, and coercion is an empty act, really, in a world that is built on patriarchal, white, heteronormative capitalism. Do you really want to see any kind of possibility for equity, justice, and an environment where it isn't dangerous just to be a woman out in the world? Then you need emancipation. You need free and available birth control, childcare, housing, healthcare, and all of the essentials of life, including education and the ability to actually self-actualize. Over the last 2 weeks, we talked about seizing the means of production. Worker power, you know, popular power, applies more to every disenfranchised, at-risk person than it does to more traditionally privileged classes. And make no mistake, when we talk about the global poor, you know, quote unquote, we're talking about women. Even here in the U.S., in jobs that pay less than $11 an hour, 70% of those workers are women. 79% of those women that are earning less than $11 an hour have higher than a high school diploma under their belt. In every state of the union, except one, Illinois, where it's 50%, women are the majority of minimum wage workers. In fact, in 11 states, including Wisconsin, women make up greater than 70% of the workers earning minimum wage or less. There can be no agency or freedom of any kind within the ligatures of wage slavery. Any feminist movement worth its salt must be emancipatory or it is useless. I'd like to read a translated excerpt from the essay, Our Feminism Must Be Anti-Capitalist, by Celeste Murillo and Andrea Daughtry. The fight against patriarchy must be anti-capitalist. The urge to revive an alliance between the women's movement and the working class in a country like the U.S. speaks to the possibilities of strengthening an anti-capitalist wing inside the new women's movement. Similarly, in Argentina, Chile, and other countries, the language of anti-capitalism is heard at the meetings of the women's movement, in their manifestos, and in their mobilizations. For socialist revolutionaries, the discussion of anti-capitalism opens the doors to a fruitful debate about what strategy and political program should be implemented against patriarchal capitalism. It forces us to think of the alliances we must build to fight for our own emancipation and how we could try to mobilize the working class to take up these demands. Imagining an anti-capitalist feminism forces us to reconsider the questions of the political subject. Without working women, who make up half the class, that is the immense majority of society, there is no future. We fight for a movement of the working class, a movement of the majority, which is antagonistic to the rights of the few capitalists who control our lives. Furthermore, if it is not the working class, both women and men, who fly the banners of emancipation of the most oppressed sectors, then anti-capitalism becomes mere wishful thinking. This alliance between the working class and women fighting for their rights goes back to the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, when women were able to win the right to vote and to fight against imperialist wars. The Bolsheviks were able to achieve hitherto unimaginable rights for women by bringing the working class to power. Many of the rights that existed in the USSR in the early 20th century had not yet been won in many capitalist countries. Have not yet been won in many capitalist countries. Since then, this alliance between the working class and women has been perversely annihilated by the ruling classes, by the betrayal of union leaders who immerse the working class in pro-business unionism, and by the co-optation of social movements into the state and their depoliticized fragmentation in nonprofits. Rebuilding the historic alliance between the working class and the women's movement is a central task in the rebuilding of a truly anti-capitalist feminism. Only when there is a real stoppage of the production and circulation of goods, of the service sector, and of communications, can the more precarious and marginalized people, the housewives being hidden away in individual homes, the women in prostitution, and all of those who are worthless to this ignominious system, make their voices echo in the silence. This alliance is not a given. We must build it. Building this alliance does not mean overlooking sexism within the working class. Some sectors of the left refuse to confront workers' prejudices, ideologies fomented by the ruling classes using the institutions under their control, such as the media and schools. These sectors also refuse to put themselves on the front lines of fighting for the most basic democratic rights, arguing that the problem of women's oppression is only an expression of capitalist exploitation. At the same time, this kind of class reductionism absolves the most conscious members of the working class and even their own militants from responsibility for the reproduction of sexism. When female workers take the front lines of the struggle, like the women at PepsiCo and LATAM, this creates better conditions to both fight against sexism within the working class, but also to fight against the sexism of the bosses. The struggle against class reductionism cannot take the socialist women's movement to the opposite extreme, taking up individualistic notions of sexism that equate verbal harassment on the street with state-sponsored terrorism against women. The mass mobilization of women around the world gives a new relevance to the debate about the course that the women's movement should take in order to avoid ending up like the women's movement of the 70s. In a contradictory manner, the movement brought about partial triumphs and the expansion of rights. On the other hand, the movement was domesticated, and then the idea of a radical transformation of the capitalist system was buried. The current movement puts this debate on the table. Is the ultimate goal going to be occasional resistance to right-wing attacks, or are we going to finally build a strategy to win? The International Women's Organization, Bread and Roses, of which the authors of this piece are members, exists in Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Chile, Uruguay, Mexico, Venezuela, the Spanish state, France, and Germany. The organization actively intervenes in and builds this new women's movement in workplaces, schools, and universities with a socialist perspective. We fight for the women's movement to build roots in the working class and give examples of the revolutionary potential of this alliance. Our ideas, program, and strategy are based on the accumulated lessons learned from previous generations of revolutionary Marxists. We believe in a feminism that seeks to be a political movement of the masses, where the struggle for democratic rights and liberties is connected to a denunciation of this regime of exploitation and misery for the majority. Only a movement that seeks to defeat this system can be truly emancipatory. That was the final section of the essay. There's a piece about neoliberal feminism, which I think I would also like to read. Here we go. The liberal discourse transformed feminism, like other social movements of the oppressed, into something so harmless that it could be easily appropriated by the right. This liberal feminism stripped the women's movement of deeper social criticism and opened the doors to right-wing women. The fact that Ivanka Trump can be presented as a representative of conservative feminism shows what a quagmire liberal feminism is trapped in. Sectors of the ruling classes do not have any problem arguing that women, ethnic minorities, and LGBT people should have positions of power in capitalist society. This is how Hillary Clinton presented herself in the elections, the clearest example of imperialist or neoliberal feminism. But Clinton failed to convince enough women to vote for her in order to break the glass ceiling and be an effective alternative to the Republican candidate, who epitomized modern misogyny. Her corporate feminism fell flat in the face of the problems affecting millions of wage laborers, unemployed workers, black people, and immigrants. Okay, so that was a brief excerpt from the larger essay, Our Feminism Must Be Anti-Capitalist, authored and translated by Celeste Mutio and Andrea Daatri. So radical feminism must be emancipatory, and equally it must be intersectional, or it is BS. That will bring us nicely to the topic of pride. Many of the reasons stated already apply to what could be deemed queer liberation. LGBTQIA plus folk are historically, and very much in our modern day, a highly at-risk, disenfranchised population. The fact that many of them are also women, both trans and cisgendered, means that the earlier arguments made in this episode apply doubly. The very fact that our modern world continues to literally criminalize the mere existence of LGBT folk is a testament to the structural violence inherent in this system. Every year, you will see agitprop which tries desperately to remind us of the violent history behind our modern-day pride parades and pride displays and celebrations. The police state, the carceral state, the structural violence of the military state all exist as enemies to queer bodies, non-binary bodies, black and brown bodies. Pride began with a brick, a radical act of defiant self-defense in the face of police aggression, and a state which criminalizes non-heteronormative society. Queer liberation must be anti-capitalist for the plain and simple reason that the two are oppositional forces. Feminism and capitalism are opposed, yes, but it's never been illegal to be a woman. Indeed, women were historically property of their husband, yes, but never could the state detain or kill you just for the revolutionary act of being a woman. The act of existing in this world as an LGBT person is an act of radical defiance of everything capitalism creates and stands for. We talked about it a little bit earlier, rainbow capitalism, or what's sometimes referred to as pink capitalism. The commodification, sterilization, and packaging of queer culture for sale is just another, not new, disgusting example of how capitalism will always steal the rhetoric and methodology of radical social movements and labor movements, so long as that rhetoric and those methodology can serve a profitable bottom line. It's been doing it forever, and it's going to continue until it's eradicated. Let it never be forgotten that the labor movement, the emancipatory movement, although often it's been painted as a movement of the white working class and the white working class men, that would be a false history. Women, people of color, and LGBTQIA plus folk have always been and always will be an instrumental part and a founding part of the revolutionary labor movement, of the emancipation movement in general. There ends the notes that I prepared for this episode. And because the beginning of every episode talks about one of the topics of the show being what the future could look like, imagining a world beyond our current structurally violent system, let's take a second and let's imagine for just a moment how a world after capitalism may reflect differently on women and LGBTQIA+ folk. Well, we said it before that capitalism is inherently a white patriarchal system, right? Racism is inherent. Sexism and misogyny is inherent. The system creates power imbalances. Well, what comes from a system that is more equitable? What comes from a system wherein our basic human needs are met? We've talked about this a little bit in the past, but there is strong evidence available in peer-reviewed data that providing people with what they need to survive quite understandably empowers them. Beyond that, removing somebody from a violent situation, whether that situation is one of precarity, wherein you do not know where your next meal is coming, whether that situation is one of houselessness, where you're sleeping on the streets, or you don't know where you're going to be able to sleep next, whether that situation is one of literal violence, whether that violence is being perpetrated upon you by a spouse or a partner, family member, friend. If you can remove someone from a situation of danger, and if you can emancipate them to a situation of larger freedom and safety, that person's circumstances improve exponentially. Quite simply put, in a world where the illegitimate hierarchy of patriarchy has been dismantled and defeated, and greater equity has been attained, finally, you will have created a situation wherein people, as equals, can cooperate and collaborate and communally work together in an atmosphere of non-hierarchical, horizontal community to actually figure out what needs to get done and how we would like to do it. Beyond that, you will no longer have this kind of boys' club situation where men can continue to appoint one another to positions of power or inherit positions of power, because those positions of power will no longer exist. Same goes exactly for heteronormative people. When there is no longer any legitimate form of hierarchy, when there is no longer any situation under which someone can hold power over another person, then we will be free to be our best selves. Because right now, that kind of power imbalance is being very much rewarded. And the people who can put themselves in positions of power are going to abuse it. I think that we can make a better world. I think we're slowly getting there. But to do it right, queer liberation and feminism must be anti-capitalist. Thank you for tuning into The Anti here on WXRW. I'm your host, NTSC, and I'll be back again to discuss further topics as they relate to freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes available at creamcitymedia.com/anti. Learn more about the show at riverwestradio.com.